charges against climate activists who are part of peaceful civil disobedience actions. I would say it's one of the most terrifying effects that we're seeing worldwide, as a climate crisis demands us to act drastically, radically, and promptly. We see governments being busy bullying climate activists.
The name Letzte Generation, which is the name of the group I belong to, translates to Last Generation. This name is derived from a Barack Obama quote, which was, I think, in 2015. We are the first generation to feel the effect of climate change and the last generation who can do something about it. Maybe the most dramatic response from German authorities to the peaceful protests of Letzte Generation have been house raids on the accusation that these people were a criminal organization.
To me, climate activists are like the canaries in the coal mines. We're not protesting for fun. We're not protesting to gain on a personal level anything except a livable future.
The escalating impacts of the climate crisis and frustration with governmental inaction are fueling protests. Climate protesters in many Western democracies are resorting to the kinds of peaceful civil disobedience used by the civil rights and similar movements.
This is no longer action against climate activists. This is action against democracies and the freedom of the people.
The way the authorities are looking at us is basically as a problem to get rid of.
They're hoping with enough repression, we'll give up and we won't get any building of the movement.
Many of these countries suppressing these protests have repeatedly pushed other, more repressive governments to allow protests. This is because they know that the right to protest plays a vital role in democracies. Protests allow individuals to advocate for change, hold companies and governments accountable for their climate commitments, and engage in public affairs to drive sustainable solutions. Yet just when they should be welcoming public concern about the existential threat of climate change, they are acting like the autocrats they criticize.
Somewhere at the end of January 2023, I got arrested with seven other Dutch citizens who are very much worried about the climate crisis. And that was because we posted online that we were gonna protest against fossil subsidies in Holland.
Sloot and his fellow activists were detained before the protest and later convicted of the felony of sedition for inciting others to commit a criminal offense. Other climate activists have been held in preventative detention to stop them from attending protests.
I was detained and brought to jail in September 2023. We were about 45 people arrested out of these hundreds who had been protesting in the state of Bavaria. The judge, he asked me if I was going to continue doing these protests, and as we affirmed that, we were sent to jail for the next 10 days.
At a certain point, I realized that nonviolent civil disobedience was what was going to raise the necessary level of awareness about the climate crisis.
Peaceful civil disobedience, which involves an act of deliberate lawbreaking, is recognized as a form of exercising the rights of freedom of expression and freedom of assembly under international human rights law. Any punishment should be proportionate.
Our version of climate protest is to disrupt the public, to call the public into the conversation.
We went into the museum with washable nursery school finger paint, and we approached the little dancer in her protective box, which no other children in the world have. And it was never our intention to cause any harm. There is a difference between creating the appearance of damage and actually damaging and injuring things. My hands looked bloody and Tim's were black for dripping oil.
Hello, friends.
And what these actions do is wake people up. It's designed to engage the public in their emotional centers.
We need our leaders to take serious action, to tell us the truth about what's happening with the climate.
And then we were arrested, as we were expecting to be. The first charge was conspiracy against the United States of America. The second was a felony damage charge for injuring a National Gallery exhibit.
We're just doing this for our children.
Each of those charges have a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison and a monetary fine of up to $500,000. The conspiracy charge equated me with the January 6th insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol trying to overthrow our government violently with weapons and massive destruction. And what I did that day at the National Gallery is completely nonviolent for the common good, which is what civil disobedience is.
Joanna made a plea deal due to a debilitating health condition and was sentenced to 2 months in a federal facility. Tim Martin is waiting to go to trial. Some climate protesters face restrictions on how they defend themselves against criminal charges. In some courts, climate protesters are being prohibited from discussing the motivations behind their actions, undermining their right to a fair trial. Instead of prosecuting protesters, government should see climate protesters and activists as allies. After all, they have been more successful than governments in raising awareness about this existential challenge.
The fact is that climate activism is not something you're born into, but it's something you stand up to do no matter where you are in your life. And I would say, from all the years of activism and for all the thousands of people I've spoken with, the one really most powerful answer to desperation is action.
A new video by Climate Rights International released along with the group's new report on Thin Ice, Disproportionate Responses to Climate Change Protesters in Democratic Countries. We're joined now by two guests here in New York, the climate activist Joanna Smith, who was jailed for 60 days in federal prison for defacing an exhibit that displayed Degas' Little Dancer sculpture at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. We're also joined by Linda Lochtier, legal director of Climate Rights International. So we just saw this video of what the climate protesters like Joanna are doing. But talk about the crackdown on them and why you focused on Western countries.
We started noticing that there were these harsh sentences being imposed on climate protesters in countries that traditionally have been very vocal about the right to freedom of assembly, that have criticized other countries about their crackdowns on protests. And so we thought it was an interesting thing to look at. And what we found is that in a number of these wealthy democratic countries, the sorts of sentences being used and the treatment of climate protesters is truly reaching a very repressive level. You have very long sentences being imposed. As you heard, you have people being put in preventative detention in order to prevent them from attending protests. You have water cannons and pain grips being used against peaceful protesters. So it's really striking how these countries who have held themselves up as beacons of rule of law are essentially repressing peaceful protest.
But it's also the case that the countries that we associate with having the most progressive climate policies, I mean, Holland, Germany, et cetera, that they're featured so prominently in the film and in the report as ones that are also cracking down on climate activists. So if you could talk about that, like what most surprised you in what you found?
I mean, it is surprising, but I think that although they are more progressive, they aren't moving fast enough. None of them are moving fast enough. And I think a lot of protesters are, people are frustrated with lack of action by their governments. They feel like they have to be out in the streets because this crisis is, it's here. And the response has been, well, this kind of messes up our day. This causes disruption. I mean, the truth is all protest causes disruption. But the response by a lot of these governments has been to enact new laws, to arrest people, to ban people from protesting in order to essentially make it easy for everybody else to get around.
And, of course, these Western countries, these so-called the advanced industrialized countries, are the ones that are causing the greatest amount of climate catastrophe, which brings us to Joanna Smith, this protest you did at the National Gallery in D.C. For our radio audience, they might not have been able to picture what exactly you did with Degas' little dancer at age 14.
Yes. We decided that all of the things we had been doing as community activists, advocates, all of the electoral work, we were trying to get the right people in office. We were showing up to all the rallies and marches. We have been protesting at fossil fuel infrastructure sites. We have engaged our electeds, done citizen lobbying. None of that is working. As we just noted, the crisis is here now. It's unfolding in front of us, and our governments are failing us. What can we do as concerned citizens when faced with what is happening to our children's future and that of children around the world? Tim Martin and I decided that we needed to take some dramatic action. We wanted it to be peaceful. We wanted it to be nonviolent. But we wanted it to get the attention that this climate breakdown deserves. And unfortunately, mainstream media has not been covering it. You guys do a great job. You're an exception. We thought, how can we create the impression of the urgency of what's unfolding? So we did go to the National Gallery in our nation's capital. We chose Degas' very famous sculpture of a little ballerina girl called Little Dancer, age 14. We chose her because she was very protected. She is displayed in a climate-controlled box. She's shockproof in this museum.
Plexiglass
on a pedestal. She's beautiful. The whole world loves her. There are copies of her all around the world. She stands for defiance in the face of vulnerability. Tim and I are parents. Tim has two boys. I have two boys. And we wanted to highlight a beautiful work of art about a child that the world values. And we wanted to make a point, which we did in our speech that we delivered at the gallery that day, that while this artifact of a child is so well protected and so beloved, we are sacrificing millions and millions of children around the world, particularly in the global south, particularly the children that are least to blame for our emissions crisis. And we wanted to challenge anyone who saw our protest to think about, what do we really value? What do we really hold true and dear? Is it a sculpture, or is it real children around the world?
And explain what you were charged with, two felonies.
Yes, we were charged with two felonies for gently applying washable nursery school finger paint to the outside of this property of the National Gallery. We never intended, nor did we, damage the art itself. But we wanted to create a symbolic act of we rendered some symbolic speech. We applied black and red paint to the outside, the red symbolizing our human life force and our culpability in the crisis, the black symbolizing the oil and gas, the fossil fuel climate criminals who are wreaking the destruction. We created some very naive art of our own on the pedestal, illustrating some of the problems that are befalling our planet, massive extreme weather events, unspeakable heat, tragic fires breaking out all around the globe. And we illustrated that. And then we gave a speech about what we expect our government to do, which is take a lot more action and faster.
You pled guilty, and you've just gotten out of jail. You served 60 days, and Tim is about to go to trial.
That's correct.
I wanted to turn to Linda on this very interesting issue. At the end of the video, you talk about problems with what happens to protesters when they are charged and when they go to trial, saying they should be able to explain the science behind climate change and why their actions are in the public interest. Many people may not realize often you cannot explain this in court. They just look like people who came to deface beautiful art.
That is correct. In many courts, the judge will say, well, that's not relevant. Why you did it? You did this act. The only issue at court is whether you did or did not do that act. And there's actually been instances in the United Kingdom where the judge has told the defendants that they can't explain their motivations. And when they have spoken about climate change anyway, jailed them for contempt. So people are not only being forbidden from talking about the reasons why they have taken these actions, how they're motivated by their fear for the planet, for the future, for their children, but they're also actually being jailed if they try and make those arguments.
And so the jury, if there is a jury trial, never hears.
No.
And so, Joanna, if you could talk about, I mean, this was not your first act of a climate protest. You did many other things prior to this. If you could talk about the steps that you did take, and how would you advise young climate justice activists now? What do you think they should be doing?
Well, I think that the repression that Tim and I have faced here in the United States is designed to dissuade these young activists from doing what is necessary to address the current crisis. And what is necessary is to use our voices, to use our bodies, to use our political power to put an end to the desecration of our sacred and beautiful planet by capital forces that are only interested in greed and profit. But I would encourage people to do their homework about location, about jurisdictions, about what the risks that they may face entail. Most grassroots organizations that are doing direct action around climate are very well supported by legal teams. There's a lot of good advice out there about what your rights are as a protester. And it's a matter of insisting upon our government actually upholding our rights to free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Linda Lochtier, Legal Director of Climate Rights International, and Joanna Smith, climate activist with the group Declare Emergency. We'll link to Climate Right International's new report on thin ice, disproportionate responses to climate change protesters in democratic countries. Coming up, Cherokee journalist Rebecca Nagel, author of the new book, By the Fire We Carry, The Generations Long Fight for Justice on Native Land. Stay with us.
of the Liars by London Grammar featuring Nature. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with the award-winning Cherokee writer and journalist Rebecca Nagel. She's the author of the new book, By the Fire We Carry, The Generations-Long Fight for Justice on Native Land. The book looks at the more than a century-long fight for tribal sovereignty in eastern Oklahoma and what it says about democracy and the American empire.
Rebecca Nagel also explored the issue in the podcast This Land, which was nominated for a Peabody Award in 2021. Rebecca joins us here in New York. It's great to have you with us. Lay out the stories that you tell here in the book.
Yeah, so the book goes into McGirt v. Oklahoma, which was a Supreme Court decision in 2020 that resulted in the largest restoration of tribal land in U.S. history. And that case actually started in a surprising place. It started as a murder in 1999, and the man convicted of murder, Patrick Murphy, was sentenced to death by the state of Oklahoma. And his federal public defender came up with a novel legal theory. She said, you know what? Oklahoma didn't have jurisdiction to prosecute this man, let alone sentence him to death, because the crime happened on his tribe's reservation, Muscogee Nation's reservation. The state of Oklahoma said, well, that reservation, not only does it not exist, it hasn't existed for over 100 years. And that question went all the way to the Supreme Court. And really what this case was a test of, the law was clearly on the tribe's side, and the question was, would the Supreme Court follow the law, or would it capitulate to the demands of non-Native residents and the state of Oklahoma and say, well, that's what the treaty says and that's what Congress says, but we're not really going to follow it. And the significance of McGirt, you know, isn't that the Supreme Court overturned anything or striked anything down, but it was just that the court, when it came to indigenous rights, followed the law, and sadly, that's quite rare.
And talk about the Cherokee Nation leader, Major Ridge.
Yeah, so Major Ridge is my great-great-great-great-grandfather. And he made a controversial decision along with his son, John Ridge, that impacted the history of our tribe. And so in the 1830s, the U.S. government had an unrelenting policy of ethnic cleansing, saying that all indigenous nations basically living within the U.S. at that time had to move west of the Mississippi. And the state of Georgia was terrorizing Cherokees on their own land. And my ancestors decided against the will and the government of Cherokee people that the best way for Cherokees as a people and as a nation to survive was to move west. So they signed our tribe's removal treaty. What followed that was the Trail of Tears. So U.S. militiamen and army soldiers literally rounded Cherokees up at gunpoint, herded our tribe into open air stockades, marched people west, and a quarter of the population dies. And so the book also shares that story to talk about why the contemporary land rights matter. How many generations of sacrifice have led to Supreme Court decisions like this one?
Can you talk about the Trail of Tears, Rebecca, and talk about the story of how it is sanitized and what exactly the 80,000 people that were forced west, what were taught in school, if we're taught anything, and what in fact you unveil and reveal and many Native Americans know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little wild, but historians actually still debate whether or not the U.S. committed genocide. You know, the term at the time didn't exist. It was coined in 1944 during the Holocaust. The Cherokee word for our removal is tgeje'i lustana'i. It literally means when they drove us. It's the same word that we use to talk about herding animals. And so the Army built 25 open-air stockades. And in 25 days, they rounded up 15,000 people and herded them into those open-air stockades. One of the women that was being herded was actually given birth, and they wouldn't let her rest. And she eventually just sort of laid down on the ground and died. There was no sanitation or shelter in the stockades. And in a few months, thousands of people had died. People then had to walk west. And, you know, the estimate is that 4,000 people died. There's a contemporary scholar that says with the sharp decline in birth rates, the total death toll is probably, or the total loss of life is probably closer to 10,000. And that's out of a population of 16,000. And I think people have this vague notion that, you know, people had to walk a long ways and a lot of people died and it was tragic. But I think we don't have a concept of how violent some of these chapters of our history are, and how we haven't gone back as a country and said, okay, we committed genocide, this was wrong, we need to change our laws, we need to make sure that something like this doesn't ever happen again. We've just moved on and forgot about it.
I mean, it's a deeply historical book, but if you could talk about how these policies still inform American law today.
Absolutely. And so there's some great work by a legal scholar named Maggie Blackhawk, and she really lays bare the way that the policies and the power our government gave itself to dispossess indigenous peoples of our land still governs how we treat people living at the margins of U.S. empire. And so when our government wanted to ban Muslims from entering our country, separate migrants at the border, detain enemy combatants indefinitely, or suspend the international rules of war to fight terror, it used principles of federal Indian law to do so. And so a lot of times we treat, you know, Native American history like this distant chapter, and the legal terrain it created as some sort of siloed backwater of American law, but actually it's foundational.
Talk about the title of your book, Rebecca, By the Fire We Carry.
Yeah, it's inspired by a Joy Harjo poem, and the line in the poem is, I keep warm by a fire carried through cruelty. And one of the things that our Southeastern tribes share is that we had mother towns and people were connected by our ceremonial fires. And during the Trail of Tears, people brought their fires, and those fires still burn in Oklahoma. And so it's the literal fire that our tribes have kept all these years, but it is also, you know, the symbolic fire of our continued fight for justice on Native land.
So this is an election year. As we approach, if you could say, as we approach November, what's at stake for Indigenous people in this election?
You know, it's, to me, what is frustrating is I think that Native voters often get left out. You know, we saw election night in 2020, CNN called Native voters in the state of Arizona literally something else. We're not seeing Native people talked about in election coverage, even though we're key constituencies in swing states like Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin. And so we need political leaders to really pay attention. You know, one of the key issues affecting tribes right now is how criminal jurisdiction works on reservations. And so tribes are actually prohibited from prosecuting non-Native people who commit crimes on our land, not for all, but for most crimes. And that's something that Congress and the president could help fix. So, I mean, and that's just one example of many. And we really need not just politicians, but sort of our media to pay more attention to issues that are important to Native voters.
Well, we want to thank you for being with us. Welcome to New York. Rebecca Nagel, Cherokee writer, award-winning journalist. Her new book is titled By the Fire We Carry, The Generations-Long Fight for Justice on Native Land. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Sharifa Gokaduz, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. To see job openings at Democracy Now!, you can go to democracynow.org. You can get our podcast video or audio wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.